In our study, we're continuing and go forward with John chapter 8. We know that in John chapter 7, we're about 6 months from the crucifixion of Jesus. And I know Richard doesn't write in his Bible, but sometimes I like to make notations in mine at key places. And this is a distinct turning point in the preaching of Jesus. You'll note that he walked in Galilee. He would not walk in Judea because the Jews sought to kill him. That's going to be significant to our study tonight. We know that on this particular feast, and by the way, what feast was it? Anyone? The feast of booths or tabernacles, yes. And we've noted that his brothers did not believe, even at this point in his ministry, him to be the Christ. And they contended that you need to go up to this feast and declare yourself. And Jesus identified in verse 6 of chapter 7, my time is not yet come. Your time is always ready. Eventually, Jesus did go up to the feast, but he went up privately. And we know that some significant things began to occur in the 7th chapter. Chris talked with us last week, verse 28, about how that he cried in the temple, teaching and saying, you both know me and know whence I am. I know, or I am not come of myself, but he that sent me is true, whom ye know not. We know in verse 30 that they sought to take him, but no man laid hands on him because his hour was not yet come. Now, in the 7th chapter, Chris has been talking with us about the evidence of the miracles that Jesus has performed. And in verse 31, it tells us that of the multitude, many believed on him. And they said, when the Christ shall come, will he do more signs than those which this man hath done? So there seems to be some debate going on about who Jesus is and whether or not he is the prophet that Moses had spoken of in times gone by. And I'm going to try while I'm talking about this to get the screen up for the charts we're going to be looking at. But as the thought continues to develop, that seems to be the question. Some were persuaded that this is the Christ. Others were saying, well, no, maybe he's not. Others were questioning whether or not the rulers might know or be willing to admit that he is indeed the Christ. But we find that the leaders of the Jews are very jealous about Jesus as he continues to teach and draw more and more popularity. And so in verse 32, the chief priest and the Pharisees sent officers to take him. And I'm convinced that these were officers of the Jewish Sanhedrin court. They're sent to arrest Jesus. And what did they find when they found Jesus teaching? Did they find somebody who presented himself as a criminal, somebody that needed to be arrested? Well, no, that wasn't what Jesus did. In fact, you'll know in verse 40, some of the multitude, when they heard these words, said, this is of a truth the prophet. Others said, this is the Christ, verse 41. But some said, what doth the Christ come out of Galilee? Hath not the scripture said that the Christ would come or cometh of the seed of David and from Bethlehem, the villages or village where David was? Now, we noted in our last study that there was some mention that Jesus would be teaching in Galilee just as he was doing. But evidently they were ignorant of the scriptures. They didn't know. And Chris talked with us some about those things, why that they had taken the position that they had. And then when these officers of the court returned, not having arrested Jesus, their explanation was, never man so spake. And Chris talked with us a little bit about how that he spoke with authority and he spoke not as their rulers. And we saw that evidenced in the Sermon on the Mount, Matthew chapter 7. But even so, the question is asked in verse 48, hath any of the rulers believed on him or the Pharisees? Often our decisions about what we believe, we stick our finger in the air as if to test the winds and see who believes what or what our favorite periodical or our favorite preacher has to say about this. And then that's the course that we take. And it appears that that's the influencing factor here of many of these. But Nicodemus, now we've talked about Nicodemus a number of times, noted in John chapter 3 that he saw the evidence for what it was. Can a man do the things that you do except God be with him? And so Nicodemus recognized the power of the miracles to verify the claims that Jesus had. And Nicodemus, as a leader, a credible leader among the Jews, he said, "Doth our law judge a man except it first hear from himself and know what he doeth?" And that sounds fair, doesn't it? Are we going to condemn a man without ever listening to him, without ever hearing any answers that he has to any of our questions? Now, what was the attitude of the leaders of the Jews even now toward Nicodemus? Well, he's got you too, hasn't he? In verse 52, they answered and said unto him, "Art thou also of Galilee? Search and see out of Galilee ariseth no prophet." Well, if you'd search, you'd find that their information was incorrect. For indeed that was the case. And the last part of verse 53 is included in the American Standard Translation in the first part of the paragraph that begins in chapter 8. Verse 53 of the 7th chapter says, "And they went every man unto his own house." Now, what has happened is they can't arrest Jesus. They really don't have anything at this point whereupon to accuse him. But now that presents us with an introduction to the 8th chapter. What is it that they intend to do with Jesus? What do they want to do with him?
Well, they want to crucify him.
They want to kill him. They just want to kill him. And the anger, the hatred that they have for him, I think is just incredible. In the context of John chapter 7, Jesus had rebuked them and said to them, "Judge not according to appearance, but judge righteous judgment." Is their judgment of Jesus righteous? Well, they're not even willing to listen to him. They're not willing to ask him an intelligent question and allow him to speak in his own defense. Nicodemus understands that righteous judgment, according to the law, would demand a hearing. But they're not willing to give Jesus a fair hearing to anything that he has said or done. Now, in John the 8th chapter, if you'll note reading beginning in verse 1, it says, "But Jesus went unto the Mount of Olives, and early in the morning he came unto the temple, and all the people came unto him, and he sat down and taught them." Now, what do you like to do early in the morning? Get up early and go listen to somebody preach? Well, maybe, but maybe not. What we see here is Jesus has gained the popularity of the people through his teaching, through the miracles that have given credibility to his claims. Early in the morning, he went into the temple and began to teach. And what did he find? He sat down and there was a multitude. He taught all the people. A multitude of people have come to listen to what he has to say. Now, a thing that I found interesting in preparing for the study, in verse 1, it says, "But Jesus went unto the Mount of Olives." Where did Jesus go at night? To the Mount of Olives. It seems that during this period of time that we're talking about, it was his custom to camp over at the Mount of Olives and then walk to the temple in the city of Jerusalem and preach in the temple. And they had some reason to expect that he would be there and that he would be there early. So an audience has gathered and Jesus presents himself. He sat down and taught these people. Now in verse 3, it tells us that the scribes and the Pharisees brought a woman caught in adultery, and having set her in the center of the court, set her in the midst of them, as the American Standard Translation renders that. The thing I find interesting about that is they have caught this woman in the act of adultery. Now, other studies, as we talk about marriage and divorce and those kind of things, it necessitates us to talk about adultery, which brings up this passage. This passage, as it is discussing adultery, demands a definition. What is adultery? Well, is it just thinking something, as some believe in Matthew 5 in the Sermon on the Mount? Is it just thinking something in your heart that constitutes the sin that this woman is participating in? Is this woman caught reading something? Is she caught looking at the computer? What's this woman doing?
She was caught with another man that wasn't her husband.
She was caught with another man that was not her husband. Isn't that simple? She was caught in the act of committing sexual immorality, and I don't like that expression because that is the translation of the New American Standard Translation, but what we want to note is that that's a real broad definition. This woman was caught having unlawful intercourse with a man, not her husband. Now, that's important. She was caught in the act. She was caught red-handed. We sometimes use the expression, she was caught with her hand in the cookie jar. Well, yes, this woman was caught. The evidence was compelling. There was no questioning what this woman has been doing or what she has become. She has become an adulteress. Now, who else should have been presented? I find it interesting that these people are very much concerned about Jesus' response. What are we going to do with this woman? Well, turn in your Bible, if you will, to a couple of Old Testament passages. In the book of Leviticus, we'll start there in chapter 20. And let's read some, beginning at verse 10. In Leviticus chapter 20, in verse 10. Randy Childs, would you read that for me, please?
Leviticus 20, verse 10. The 110, just the one verse?
Yes, please.
If there is a man who commits adultery with another man's wife, one who commits adultery with his friend's wife, the adulterer and the adulteress shall surely be put to death.
Here's what the law said. These Jews that have brought this woman before Jesus to see what he will say are trying to get Jesus to implement what the law says. Keep that in mind. But what did the law say that they should have done? Who should have been brought for any judgment to take place?
Both of them.
Now, if you'll continue reading, Randy, I'm not asking you to do that, but if you'll notice the rest of this paragraph in Leviticus chapter 20, it talks about what to do where incest has occurred, where homosexuality has occurred, where bestiality has occurred. But there's something woefully lacking in the judgment of these Pharisees who bring this woman that is taken in adultery. Jesus has been critical of them. Judge not according to appearance, but judge righteous judgment. They bring this woman that's taken in adultery. Is their judgment going to be righteous judgment when they've not brought the man according to the law? And in Deuteronomy chapter 22, furthermore, you'll note in verse 22, again it says, if a man be found lying with a woman married to a husband, then they shall both of them die. The man that lay with the woman and the woman, so shalt thou put away the evil from Israel. Now, my question is this. These folks who bring this woman that's taken in adultery, are they real concerned about what the law says? No, they don't care what the law says. They're not obeying the law. So then why did they bring this woman before Jesus? Notice in the wording of the text there in we'll read verse 4, 5, and 6. It says, they said unto him, teacher, this woman hath been taken in adultery in the very act. Now in the law, Moses commanded us to stone such. What then sayest thou of her? And this they said, trying him, that they might have whereof to accuse him. Now let's pause right there. What's their interest? Are they interested in doing what the law says concerning this woman, Daphne?
Yeah, no, of course they're not, because they didn't bring the man with them. But the thing is, they weren't allowed to execute anybody during this time period, right?
No, they were not. And we're
so
going to see
if what... Jesus had said, you should kill her, then they could have taken him to the Romans and said, he's wanting us to do this horrible thing that we're not allowed to do.
Yeah.
So one way or the other, either he's going to go against the law and say, don't do anything, or he's going to say, she should be stoned, and then they could involve the Romans. They thought they had him in a box.
Mm-hmm. You know, these are not the only folks that thought they had him. I find it really interesting in studying the Bible, especially in the life of Jesus, how many folks thought they had him. We've got him now. And he silences them, as we see him doing here. And we'll study that. And you're right about that. I got a chart coming up that shows the apparent dilemma they think they presented for Jesus, and then the dilemma that Jesus puts them in, and see their response. I have a couple of passages that I want to look at first, however. You'll notice in the account of Matthew in chapter 16, there in verse 1. Matthew chapter 16, verse 1. There the text says, and the Sadducees, or Pharisees and Sadducees, came and trying him, asked him to show them a sign from heaven. But he answered and said, when it is evening, ye say it will be fair weather, for the heaven is red. And in the morning, it will be foul weather today, for the heaven is red and lowering. Ye know not how to discern the face of the, or you know how to discern the face of the heaven, but ye cannot discern the signs of the times. An evil and adulterous generation seeketh after a sign, and there shall no sign be given unto it, but the sign of Jonah, and he left them and departed. Notice, if you will, he didn't elaborate about Jonah. You think these folks that the Pharisees and the Sadducees knew anything about Jonah? Well, I'd like to think they'd read the book and had some familiarity with it. But they want him to perform some kind of a sign. He said, there's already been a sign. There's going to be one. But it'll be like Jonah. That's the sign that's given. Now go back and read about Jonah. And of course, we know the application that's made of that a little bit later on. But in Matthew chapter 19, in verse 3, again, Daphne, they've got a underhanded purpose, dishonest purpose. In verse 3, they're asking Jesus about marriage. Is it lawful, or actually about divorce? Is it lawful for a man to divorce his wife for every cause? Now, why'd they ask him that? They're trying to hang him on the horns of dilemma. And how did he answer it? He said, have you not read that he who made them in the beginning made them male and female, and said, for this cause shall a man leave his father and mother and shall cleave unto his wife, and the two shall become one flesh. Do you find it interesting at all that here is something that is so fundamental, so simple, that it existed in the beginning? Have you not read what God said way back there in Genesis chapter 2? And here we are talking about the Pharisees who prided themselves in their knowledge and their obedience to the law. Haven't you read what God said about marriage? Do you see any insult that that would present to them? You're supposed to be so knowledgeable. You're here to put me on the test. Haven't you read what God said about marriage in the beginning? And then you'll note in verse 6, they that are so, or Jesus said, so that there are no more two, but one flesh, what therefore God hath joined together, let not man put asunder. Now let me ask you, have you ever been in a class and you've asked a question in a class that you knew the answer to? You're just asking to see what the teacher will say. And then he's answered the question, and now you've been silenced, but you didn't have sense enough to keep your mouth shut. So you've got to ask another question. And this is what the Jews did. In verse 7, they say unto him, why then did Moses command to give a bill of divorcement and to put her away? Oh, we got him now. Verse 8, he saith unto them, Moses, for your hardness of heart, suffered you to put away your wives, but from the beginning it hath not been so. And I say unto you, whosoever shall put away his wife, except for fornication, and shall marry another, committeth adultery. And he that marrieth her when she is put away, committeth adultery. Have you noticed in some of these episodes where the Jews ask a question that becomes an I've got you question? Jesus not only answers their question, but he answers beyond their question to answer their position on some things. And so he does here. And in Matthew chapter 22, you'll notice in verse 15, Matthew 22. In verse 15, this dimension of Matthew 22 ought to call to mind the context where Jesus is being asked a lot of questions that are designed to ensnare him. And you'll note that the Pharisees, they took their turn there in verse 15. And then the Sadducees, they had to take their turn in verse 23. And it says, on that day there came unto him Sadducees, they that say there is no resurrection. And they asked him and said, teacher, Moses said, if a man die having no children, his brother shall marry his wife and raise up seed unto his brother. Now there were with us seven brethren, and the first married deceased and having no seed left his wife unto his brother. And you're familiar with this. And this went on down till the seventh brother had married this man's wife. And then they all die. And the question that they ask is, in the resurrection, whose wife shall she be? Do you find it ironic that here are folks that are noted in the text, they didn't believe in the resurrection, but that's the substance of their question. In the resurrection, whose wife shall she be? And I got you. Question. It's not asked for information. But in verse 29, Jesus answered and said unto them, you do err, not knowing the scriptures, nor the power of God. Now, what did the Sadducees pride themselves in? Their knowledge of the scriptures, kind of like the Pharisees. But Jesus said, you don't know the scriptures, and you don't know the power of God. In verse 30, for in the resurrection, they neither marry nor are given in marriage, but are as angels in heaven. But as touching the resurrection of the dead, have you not read that which was spoken unto you by God, saying, now let's pause here for a moment. They've asked him a scenario that appears to be a dilemma. He can't answer this, just can't answer it. And he says, you're just ignorant. You don't know what the scriptures teach. You don't know what the power of God is. Now, regarding the resurrection of the dead, haven't you read? And look at the passage that he quotes in verse 32. I am the God of Abraham, the God of Isaac, and the God of Jacob. And you read that? Now, where might they have read such a thing? Well, back over in the Old Testament, in the beginning of their being led out of Egypt by Moses, actually when Moses was being instructed to lead them out, in Exodus chapter 3, when Moses asked the question, when they say, who sent me, who shall I say? God said, I am that I am. Well, we don't even have a real nation of the Jews identified yet. They're in bondage, in captivity, and never come out yet. Moses is going back to bring them out. And you read what God said to Moses about that? Do you think it would be somewhat insulting to the intelligence of folks who prided themselves in their knowledge of the scriptures to be told you're ignorant? You don't know the scriptures, and here's such a basic one. One that you ought to very well be familiar with, much like he did in Matthew 19, much like we see in Matthew chapter 16. And to further answer them, it says in verse 32, I am the God of Abraham, the God of Isaac, God of Jacob. God is not the God of the dead, but of the living. And when the multitudes heard it, they were astonished at his teaching. But the Pharisees, when they heard that he had put to silence the Sadducees, gathered themselves together. Now, they've got to keep asking questions. They've got a lawyer, somebody that's well-schooled in what the law of Moses said, and he wants to know, teacher, what's the first and the greatest commandment? Now, like we noted a few moments ago, you ever ask a question and you've gotten it answered, and the best thing that you can do is just keep silent. Well, that's what they should have done. But they didn't do that. They keep asking questions, keep finding folks to ask questions. And Jesus answers them profoundly as he does in this context. Now, that's what we've got in John chapter 8 and in verse 6. Right on the heels of Jesus teaching them, judge righteous judgment. Don't judge according to appearance. Well, they're just the opposite of that. Now, in verses 1 through 8 of this text, we've got to say this about this text. There are some who call in question the credibility of this text. Now, frankly, I don't have a whole lot that I want to say about that, but I do want to present some things, and there's some things on the charts that we'll just look at and pass beyond them, unless you want to have a study of the subject of biblical criticism. But that's not our study. Our study is the life of Christ. But there are some who call into question the event of verses 1 through 11 of John chapter 8. And I think Merle Tinney, and this is in his book, Expositor's Bible Commentary, it's quoted in the commentary on John by, what's his name, Richard Dan, I'll think of it in a minute. It can hardly be or have belonged to the original text of this gospel, as Mr. Tinney says. It is absent from most of the oldest copies of the gospel that precede the 6th century and from the works of the earliest commentators. To say that it does not belong in the gospel is not identical with rejecting it as unhistorical. Its coherence and spirit show that it was preserved from a very early time, and it accords well with the known character of Jesus. It may be accepted as historical truth. Now, Mr. Tenney denies that it was a part of the original text of the gospel, but he does not deny the truth of what it says, as far as history is concerned. And here are some reasons to look at. There it is, Dan King. I'm going to say Dan Shipley. I knew that wasn't right. But here is the are the reasons that Dan King gives in his commentary. First, it is missing from the two earliest copies of John. Second, he said it appears in only one of the early uncials from the 5th, or as we noted earlier, the 6th century. Third, many of the later cursive manuscripts omitted, while others included, and he gives us a sampling of that. Fourth, several ancient translations omitted. Fifth, no commentator before Isthmus, and you can pronounce that, mentions this passage. Well, what we're looking at is a very simple statement that we noted at the beginning, is some of the early manuscripts don't include it. So some categorically reject it. Some of the early translations don't include it, so they categorically reject it. But we're going to study it because the material that's in it, I believe, is important. We're going to include it in our study as being valid. And something that we need to be aware of. Some scholars have compared the style of John 8, 1 through 11 with other writings of John and say, well, the style is different, therefore it's not a part of John's writings. So apart from this study of textual criticism, we're not going to do that. We're going to treat it as a true story, and we're going to study it as it is revealed to us here in John chapter 8. But we see in this, and I think this is crucial, to see how this is building. Now, those of you who have studied with me the events of the last week of the life of Jesus, see a crescendo effect in that week. It just builds and builds and builds. And here we see in these last 6 months, there is a building of tension between Jesus and the Jews. What happened in John chapter 5 that became a controversial event? The very first part of John chapter 5. What did Jesus do?
Well, Linda says that he healed on the Sabbath. This is the man at the pool of Bethesda.
He did that. And this man had been lame for 38 years. I find it just astounding that here is a man that everybody knows. Everybody knows that he's been lame for 38 years, and Jesus miraculously told him to take up his bed and walk, and he did. And all they can do is be critical of what day it was. Now, if you saw somebody perform a miracle such as this, would you not be impressed with what was done rather than simply the day that it was done on?
Not only did he heal the man, he told him to take up his bed and walk. That was work.
Yeah, well, that's how they considered it. And, of course, Jesus had somewhat to say about that. But what we want to notice, they missed the point. The miracles were to show the credibility, the credentials of our Lord. He raised a man that had never walked to be able to walk, told him to walk, and indeed he did. But rather than to see the miracle, they accused Jesus of violating the Sabbath without realizing that he's the Lord of the Sabbath, if he can do this. But this tension continues to build. What do we see happening in the 6th chapter? Jesus is performing miracles. You'll note in verse 2, it tells us, and a great multitude followed him because they beheld the signs which he did on them that were sick. Now, granted, not all of this was in Jerusalem, but what we see is the tension continuing to grow. And the multitudes are impressed with the miracles that he did. And we find in this very chapter, in the early part of it, what did he do? He fed over 5,000 men with 5 barley loaves and 2 fish. And in verse 14, what purpose were the miracles designed to serve? Credentials as to who he is. They were to authenticate his claim to be the Son of God. And when you look at chapter 6, verse 14, did this miracle of feeding the 5,000 with 5 barley loaves and 2 fish, did it serve that purpose?
This is of a truth, the prophet.
Yes. Yes. They said, this is of a truth, the prophet that cometh into the world. Well, Moses had only talked about the coming of one, and now they say this got to be him. And then the very next day, how long did that last? Well, not very long, because the next day they found him on the other side of the sea, and they want him to feed them. And when he refuses to do it, they say, work a miracle, perform a sign, so we can know who you are so we can believe that you're the Christ. Now, when you get over to the seventh chapter, the entirety of the seventh chapter, what's taking place? Well, we've noted in the seventh chapter, having studied that, there are 6 months before the crucifixion, and things are continuing now, but much more rapidly to escalate. Here we are at the Feast of Booths or Tabernacles in Judea, and there's all kinds of questions, even from among his own brothers, as to who he is. They don't believe his claim. They ridicule him. And now we find that these Jews in the eighth chapter are trying to entrap him by questioning this woman that has been taken in adultery. And as if that's not enough, when we read on just a little bit further, he claims to be, once again, the I Am. Now, are they familiar with that expression? They got it. Now, what's been happening all through this? Jesus is preaching to a large crowd of people now in John chapter 8, in the temple, in the city of Jerusalem. And this appears to be his practice. And they can't find any fault with him in reference to the law. And so, Daphne, here's the point you were establishing a while ago. They bring this woman that the law says should be stoned to death. And we noted that. Oh, we got him now. Here's a gotcha moment. You see, if he says that she's to be stoned according to the law, then we'll accuse him of violating the Roman law, because Roman law didn't permit them to carry that out. And I find this just real interesting too, Daphne, on that point. When Jesus was crucified, they jumped through all the right hoops to make sure that he was sentenced to crucifixion by Roman law. I don't know how many days later or how much time transpired. I would say not much, until we come to Acts chapter 7, where we read about Stephen, and they're not so concerned about what Roman law says. They took up stones and they stoned Stephen to death just in a heartbeat because they didn't like what he said. But now we find that they're trying to get Jesus sentenced. And so we've got an occasion here. If he says that she's not to be stoned, but turned it over to Roman authority, they say, well, you're violating the law of Moses. So either way, we've got a gotcha moment. You can't escape this. Now you're on the horns of dilemma. Well, you know, if they were seeking any kind of righteous judgment, they brought witnesses. They would have brought the man, but they're not interested in what the law says. They're just seeking occasion to accuse Jesus. And you'll note in verse 6, the latter part, it says, but Jesus stooped down and with his finger wrote on the ground. You ever hear discussions about what he wrote? That just gets to be silly. Sometimes folks are so concerned about what he wrote, they don't read the passage. You don't know what he wrote. I don't either. Nobody knows. All that is just a bunch of speculation. Some say, well, he's writing a list of names of those who accuse the woman, listing their sins. We got their name over here, their sin over here. Well, you don't know that. Others speculate that he wrote some warnings that were aimed at the scribes and the Pharisees. Well, you hadn't read what he wrote, and these folks hadn't read that either. Others speculate that Jesus was just doodling on the ground. Have you heard that explanation? Well, you don't know that either, because the text don't tell you. So when the text is silent, what are you? You be silent. Yeah. You don't know what he wrote, but we do know that he was writing something. He wrote on the ground. The text tells us that. But we also note that he stood up where he had been sitting. You'll see that in the early part of the verses that we read. But now he stood up. He's got their occasion, their attention. Now let me ask you. When you ask your mom and dad a question, and I'm sure I'm the only one that ever was in this position, did you ever find that your mom and dad just really didn't answer the question that you asked? Now, it wasn't that they were without instruction, but they didn't answer the question that you asked. And sometimes questions that are asked are just best ignored. I was talking with someone earlier about the principles involved in this, that if you listened and responded directly to everything that everybody says to you, you would be in a constant argument with just about everybody. But sometimes questions are asked for the purpose of just to see what you'll say, just to gouge you. Now, I'm sure none of you would ever do that, but that's what the Pharisees are doing. But they're not the only ones that have ever done that. There's a lot of folks ask questions of Jesus. For that reason, just as the Pharisees and the Sadducees, as we already noted numerous examples of them. But if you'll turn in your Bible to John chapter 4, I want to read another illustration. In John chapter 4, we read of Jesus in Samaria, speaking with this Samaritan woman. And you'll note in the text, well, she's there at Jacob's well. I should correct that. But what we want to note is he came to this Samaritan woman. He said, give me to drink. And the Samaritan woman said in verse 9, how is it that thou, being a Jew, asketh drink of me, who am a Samaritan woman? For Jews have no dealings with Samaritans. Now, you'll notice that Jesus just jumped right in and told her why he was talking to her, didn't he? No, he didn't tell her that. He didn't answer that question at all. Why are you talking to me? In verse 10, it says Jesus answered and said, but he didn't answer her question. He answered and said, if thou knewest the gift of God and who it is that saith unto thee, give me to drink, thou wouldest have asked of him and he would have given thee living water. Well, what does that have to do with the relationship of Jews and, I'm sorry, the Jews and Samaritans? It doesn't have anything to do with it. But that's what this woman wants to know. Why are you, as a Jew, talking to me who is a Samaritan? What does Jesus want to talk to her about? Living water. Read on. The woman saith unto him, sir, thou hast nothing to draw with, and the well is deep. Whence then hast thou that living water? Art thou greater than our father Jacob, who gave us the well and drank thereof himself and his sons and his cattle? Now, when you read that question, what's this woman asking Jesus? Just in common everyday language, how would you say what she said?
Who do you think you are?
Exactly right. Who do you think you are? To which Jesus said, I am the Christ, the Son of God. No, he didn't say that. But look at how he did say. Verse 13. Jesus answered and said unto her, everyone that drinketh of this water shall thirst again. But whosoever shall drinketh of the water that I shall give him shall never thirst. But the water I shall give him shall become in him a well of water springing up unto eternal life. And the woman said unto him, sir, give me this water, that I thirst not, neither come all this way to draw. Now, does Jesus have her attention? Here's a woman that labors hard every day to come to this well to draw water. And Jesus is talking about water that if she had this, she'd never need to drink again. And she says, I want some of that. Jesus said, go call your husband and come hither. Well, wait a minute. Woman says, I don't have a husband. Who's answering questions now? I don't have a husband. Jesus said, you well said, I have no husband. For thou hast had five husbands, and he whom thou now hast is not thy husband. This thou hast said truly, indeed. And the woman said, sir, I perceive that thou art a prophet. Our fathers worship in this mountain, and ye say that in Jerusalem is the place where men ought to worship. And Jesus said unto her, woman, believe me, the hour cometh when neither in this mountain nor in Jerusalem ye shall worship the Father. Ye worship that which ye know not. We worship that which we know, for salvation is from the Jews. What's Jesus telling this woman? What's he turned the topic of conversation unto? Just simply a drink of water? A fuss about the relationship between Jews and Samaritans? No. He's now talking to this woman about saving her soul. And the woman said, I know that Messiah cometh, he that is called Christ. When he is come, he will declare unto us all things. Jesus said unto her, I that speak unto thee am he. Brethren and friends, why didn't Jesus just tell her that when she wants to know who you think you are? Has he convinced her? He's told her all things ever she did. And she went back into the city and she said, come and see this man. He told me everything. Could it be that he's the Christ? And folks began to come out and to listen to Jesus teach. And their report was, you know, we believed first because of what you told us, but now we've heard him teach. And we believe because not just on the basis of what you've said, but because of the things we've heard from him. He is the Savior of the world. Now, what if Jesus had just answered her question up front? Why do you ask me a question? I'm a Samaritan. You're a Jew. What is this woman trying to do? She's trying to fan the flames of prejudice. Did Jesus play ball with her? No. But he taught her something, and he wound up teaching the whole village something, that if he had engaged her question, that opportunity would not have been. Some questions are just not worthy to answer. Now, the Apostle Paul told Timothy, there are folks that's going to be concerned about endless genealogies and all kinds of foolishness. You just refuse it. Just refuse it. I get somewhat annoyed sometimes when we think that we've just got to dive into the deep end and answer anything that anybody has to say, regardless of what appears to be dishonorable motives, that we've just got to do that. Jesus sometimes answered the question, but he answered it like we see here in John chapter 8 by presenting to them the dilemma. And sometimes Jesus answered the question by just not answering it. Daphne?
He eventually tells her exactly who he is, but he had to bring her along in her understanding where she would accept it and where she would understand it. If he had just said, I'm the Christ, when she asked the question, she wouldn't have had any context for it. But by leading her through this trail of reasoning from where she was at to where he was at, then he could answer her question and say, I am he. And she understood then what that fully meant. So sometimes when we talk to people, you can't come out with just the end answer because they're not at a place where they can hear it, understand it, put it in the proper context. You have to go back where they're at and lead them to the point where you can give them the answer to the question that they actually asked you.
And then they can have the light bulb moment called understanding. Now, isn't that what we call teaching? You see, there really hasn't been any teaching where there has been no communication. Fanning the flames of prejudice doesn't communicate. We see that, do we not? Yeah, notice if you will. Okay, Bruce, go ahead.
I'm just going to mention the fact is that, you know, in just this part, it just shows you a lot of maturity that we need to have. And that maturity is, you know, is... But Jesus knew what was on her mind. But in studying the scriptures, it helps us understand how we need to mature more and become the way that Jesus is. Not Jesus, but become the way that he is.
Well, that's right. We need to learn how to communicate, how to teach. Notice, if you will, the next point on the chart, if I may notice this. Jesus said to these folks in John chapter 8, he that is without sin among you, let him cast the first stone. Now, why did Jesus say that? They're concerned about what to do with this woman according to the law. Well, what did the law say? The law said in Deuteronomy 17 and in verse 7, the hand of the witnesses shall be first upon him to put him to death, and afterward the hand of all the people. So shalt thou put away the evil from the midst of thee. Now, Jesus has been put on the horns of dilemma. Are you going to choose with Moses? Or are you going to choose with the Roman law? Jesus said, well, I'll choose with what God said. Let's practice it. He that is without sin among you, let him cast the first stone. Now, what are they having to do? You see, the issue is not what would the law demand or would it be respected and obeyed. These hypocrites are going to be in the place of condemning themselves by insisting on the death penalty when they themselves have transgressed the law. Well, now, what about you? You want to put this woman to death? Let's follow the law. Bring forth the witnesses. Now, there are all kinds of speculations about why they walk away, but I want to suggest to you something here. Jesus knew why they brought this woman. In John chapter 5, notice these passages I have highlighted. For this cause, therefore, the Jews sought the more to kill him. We saw that when he had made the man who was 38 years lame able to walk. In John 7, after he walked in Galilee, he would not walk in Judea because the Jews sought to kill him. And they asked the question, Jesus asked, why do you seek to kill me? They said, well, who is it that seeks to kill you? Knowing that it was them, they were already lame plot to kill him. Jesus had told them, don't judge according to appearance, but judge righteous. The very next verse, some therefore of them of Jerusalem said, is this not he whom they seek to kill? Did they understand what was intended for Jesus? Well, there wasn't any question about it. We're going to kill you. And so now then, he that is without sin, let him be the one that takes the life of this woman that cast the first stone. Note the hypocrisy. These are determined to murder him while at the same time supposing to be interested in the sin that this woman has committed. They don't care about this woman. They're plotting to kill Jesus. These are they who are so interested in applying the law in some kind of a way that's going to cause Jesus to be accused. Now we can kill him. No. What was it that Paul said? In fact, what had Jesus, for lack of time, already said about applying law to somebody else that you refuse to apply to yourself? He'd already said that. He said, judge not that ye be not judged. What kind of judgment was he condemning? But the very judgment that we're reading about in John chapter 8. These were hypocrites. They didn't care about this woman. They're not caring about just carrying out of the law. They're concerned about being able to accuse Jesus. And the text tells us then that they all left, beginning with the eldest, and they all left. And Jesus said then to the woman, where are your accusers? Well, there's not anybody here. Nobody to accuse you, nobody to condemn you. And we know that Jesus then said, neither do I condemn thee. Now, I know I'm out of time, and I'm going to quit. Believe it or not, I'm going to quit. But I'm going to come back next week, and we've got to talk about this conclusion. Notice, if you will, that Jesus said, neither do I condemn thee. He did not deny the woman's sin. He did not tell the woman that she didn't need to change anything. There are a lot of things that Jesus did not say in John chapter 8, and we'll look at those next week. Now, I'm going to stop sharing my screen just here, and Richard, if you'll mark that, we'll start there next time and resume with John chapter 8 going forward. As I want to do, is there any question or comment on the text of John chapter 8, 1 through 11 at this point? Well, what I want to do is at this point is to extend an opportunity for somebody that might need to obey the gospel. We never know in an audience who might be present that is thinking about your station before the Lord and never obeyed the gospel. You need to do something about that. Believing that Jesus is the Christ, turn from your sin. The Bible calls that repentance. That may mean starting to do some things you haven't been doing. It may mean stopping doing some things that you're doing that you don't need to be doing. If you're thinking in that vein, then do that. Make up your mind what kind of life you're going to live. Confess your faith and be baptized into Christ. We can help you to do that. Maybe you've done that and you need prayers on your behalf. You're not living the kind of life you know you should. Repent of it. Ask God's forgiveness. We can help you make that known.